swim by. Well, I got down to the river, so lonesome I wanted to die. Oh, Lord. But when I jumped in the river, the doggone river was dry. And now it's long gone, and I'm lonesome blue.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Lloyd Carter. You're listening to Down in the Valley, the monthly show that focuses on agriculture and water issues in the San Joaquin Valley in California. We have a very good show planned for you today. We're going to interview the author of a book called Taking Back Eden, Eight Environmental Cases That Changed the World. Our guest today is Professor Oliver Houck. He's a professor of law at Tulane University. In 2005, he received the Distinguished Achievement Award from the Environmental Section of the American Bar Association. He's the editor of Environmental Law Stories. He wrote the foreword to Biodiversity in the Law, and he's written a book on water pollution, as well as many award-winning law and popular articles. Are you with us, Professor Houck?
I am, Lloyd. Thanks for the call. And since I'm in New Orleans, I have to reply to that by saying, who dat?
Who dat? Okay, well, they're probably still celebrating down there.
They clearly are. You would not believe it.
Let's tell our listeners a little bit what your book was about. Ordinary folks who go to court and accomplish almost amazing things, not only in America, but all over the world, from Russia to military regimes in Chile to the Taj Mahal, which I want to get into the particular Taj Mahal case, which is fascinating. But first I want to talk about your very opening story in the book, which was the battle to save the Hudson River. Now, as fate would have it, one of the protagonists in that great battle was a mutual friend of ours named Bob Boyle. Bob was a Sports Illustrated writer for many years and an author of books on the Hudson River. And about 15 years ago, he came out here and did a piece upon our big environmental battle in California at the time, which was the selenium poisoning of the Kesterson National Wildlife Refuge in Central California.
I remember that battle, and in fact, I remember that reporting. The thing that your listeners have to understand about Bob Boyle, he was not only a superb investigative reporter, but he was a Marine. And he went after these things on a war footing. And what he did with y'all out there was, of course, bring good reporting and national attention. What he did here that kicked off the war and, in fact, kicked off, I think, the engine of environmental progress in the United States, which are citizen lawsuits. Without them, this would be a dead game. He did more than reporting. His reporting brought him to such a level of anger and frustration that he started an organization called the Hudson River Fishermen's Association. And that group carried the battle. And it was a very strange alliance with him and other parties. It took about 12 years. It was the opening salvo of something that's still reverberating.
Well, for our listeners who aren't familiar, the first of your eight stories in your book talks about, we're going back now 40-plus years, the Hudson River was basically a sewer line for industry up and down the river in New York, and then Con Edison got into the picture and wanted to build a power plant on Storm King Mountain, which overlooks the Hudson River. Is that correct?
That's true, and this is how Bob Boyle gets into this picture. Boyle comes at it from the pollution of the river and the killing off of the fish point of view. Boyle gets assigned by Sports Illustrated to contracted to write a story about fishing on the Hudson. Nobody believed there was any fishing left in the Hudson. I used to go back and forth across the Hudson from New Jersey when I was a kid on the ferries. It smelled bad. There were dead animals floating in it, condoms, vegetables, you name it. It was a sewer. And so when Boyle reported on that, he didn't think he'd be reporting on anything. But lo and behold, he found fishers, real fishers. And not only that, he found them fishing for the great king prize fish of the East Coast. There's nothing like it in California, believe me. The striped bass. People wait all year long for the opening striped bass season. And when they leave to go fish, they leave behind what's known as striper widows, their wives, their girlfriends. And they stand out in these godforsaken places and fish for this fish, which is very powerful, very good tasting, and the catch of a lifetime. Well, the thing about this plant was that it was going to suck in enormous volumes of water from the Hudson River, enormous volumes. And nobody gave any thought when they were designing this plant about what effect that would have on the fish. Nor did Boyle. Boyle was just doing a story on, surprise, surprise, there are fish in the Hudson. And then somebody said, you want to see some fish? Go on down to the intakes at Indian Point Nuclear Reactor, which he did. And he finds, it looks like, a landfill of fish they've scraped off the intake grates for this nuclear plant. And among those fish in those piles are dead striped bass. That's like killing babies to East Coast fishermen. So he forms this organization to shut down the intake systems of these major power plants, and the next one online is Storm King Mountain, which is one half of the Storm King War. It was sort of a fisherman's revolt. The other half were people who lived up on the Hudson Highlands. And we're talking about the aristocracy of New York, the Rockefellers, the Van Cortlands, the Van Stuyvesants. I mean, these people had been the patriarchs of the Hudson for 200-300 years, the Schuylers. I mean, they ran the Revolutionary War. And so the combination of this group's sort of upper-class outrage about the power plant in their sacred heartland, the Hudson Highlands, and this blue-collar fisher power got together in a sort of an only an American marriage, right? It was kind of like the kings and the proletariat.
Right.
And they brought this case. But they didn't have any right to bring the case. Nobody had ever brought a case like this. They didn't bring a case because they were economically hurt. They didn't bring a case because it took their property. They didn't bring this case because they had any injury they could prove to the court. They were just pissed off that people were killing their fish and ruining the image of the Hudson Highlands. They had basically aesthetic injury that had never been recognized in court. Nor had citizens ever been allowed into court to argue to protect the environment. This was brand new. And so the case proceeded back and forth between the courts and the commission and the courts and the power commission. And over time, each of those issues gets resolved in favor of the litigators. And finally, after 11 years, Con Ed gave up. And they had what's known as the Peace Treaty on the Hudson. And they met at the Roosevelt Hotel in downtown New York City. And Con Ed abandoned the project.
Right.
Con Ed abandoning the project is a little like, whew, the United States abandoning the Panama Canal. I mean, it was the power company of all power companies in the United States. It was the largest utility. So this was David against Goliath times 10. And here's the interesting California aspect of this. At the same time this case was being litigated, and I didn't put it in the book because this was case two, your case, the very same issue was being litigated in the Sierras at a place called Mineral King. And the Sierra Club brought a lawsuit against a big Disney development in your backyard.
Right.
Well, I say your backyard.
No, it is our backyard.
I know it's hundreds of miles away, but...
No, it's very close. It's about 60 miles from 70 miles from Fresno in Tulare County up in the High Sierra. Disney wanted to build a ski resort.
That's it.
You're
that's
absolutely
it.
Right.
And the Sierra Club went up against it, having no more interest in the case than their heartfelt feeling and their history of defenders of the Sierras. But they had no economic injury, no property injury, no injury that the courts had ever recognized. And Sierra said, we can be here because we're the Sierra Club. And the Supreme Court did a very interesting thing. It went all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said, Sierra Club, you can't sue because you're Sierra Club, because anybody can form a group to do anything. So we're not impressed by you as a group, which I think was the wrong decision. But they went on to say, if you have any single member who is affected by this development, and here's the magic word, even aesthetically, then you may sue in that member's behalf. So they let them sue after all if they had one member to say, I don't like it. I visit up there, I hike up there, and I don't like it.
It's beautiful country. We're listening to Professor Oliver Hauck. He's the author of Taking Back Eden, 8 Environmental Cases That Changed the World. It's published by Island Press. I'm sure you can get it on Amazon and your major bookstores. Professor Hauck, I want to correct you, if I may, on one small point. When you talked about the striped bass being not in California, in fact, they were introduced into the San Francisco Bay Delta Estuary, and they have become a huge issue out here, ironically, as a non-native predator species.
Yeah.
And as you probably followed to a certain extent, the huge battle in California right now is whether we're going to be able to save our estuary.
Yep.
And ironically, you talked about the pumps at the power plants on the Hudson sucking in the fish. Well, we have gigantic pumps on the south end of the Bay Delta estuary here that are pulling in all types of fish, but in particular one called the Delta Smelt.
I'm familiar with the Delta Smelt.
Yeah, so, you know, what strikes me about the Hudson story is that it reverberates here 40 years down the road, and California's experienced some of those same problems. Now, as you write in the book, one of the ramifications that came out of the whole Hudson River battle was the Clean Water Act and a whole host of environmental laws, national laws, that came into being in the 1970s.
Well, that would overstate the case.
Well, I'm not saying that it was solely responsible.
What happened was it brought attention to the issue, and it involved citizens in the solution of the issue, and that put a lot of pressure on legislators. And in 6 years, you know, it was like the six creative years. It's this way in history, isn't it? Suddenly in Italy, you find a period of time where suddenly there are all the great painters. And then you find a time in France where there are all the great thinkers. And they're all within 30 or 40 years of each other, the great composers. And what you had in the United States from about 69 to 75 were all the great environmental laws, the Air Act, the Water Act, the this, the that, the that. There were about 20 of them. And all of them got gigged forward because people were bringing lawsuits, and industry and government that was on the receiving end of these suits said, my God, we've got to do something to get out under the pressure. So very often these lawsuits changed the game. They changed the default position. That's how I got into the field. I was a federal prosecutor. There weren't any environmental laws, but I was offended by the state of the Potomac River, where I was in the U.S. Attorney's Office. So I started suing polluters under an 1899 statute that says don't throw crap in the river. Well, none of these people believed that an 1899 law applied to them until a court said it did. Suddenly, every industry in the country went screaming to Congress saying, my God, get us off the hook. Otherwise, everything we put in the river, you're going to have these prosecutors and citizens suing us. So that brought about the Water Act. So it was an indirect kind of an effect. But right. Here is the more direct thing, Lloyd, and this is what why California is so powerful in environmental protection and very much in the lead. Every one of these new statutes had a little Mineral King provision, a little Storm King provision. And basically it said, if this program isn't working out, citizens can sue. Citizens can kick butt. They can kick the state's butt. They can kick the government's butt. They can kick industry's butt. Anybody who's violating the statute, citizens can sue, and they can get attorney's fees for it. So suddenly these groups appeared like, God, flowers in spring. They just popped up. And you have, I think at last count, you have about 18 or 20 very powerful, some are local, but locally powerful environmental groups out there. They're just, it's an extraordinary presence and extraordinary pressure.
Right. Back to the book. Of course, the book focuses on ordinary folks who go out and they see something that they believe to their hearts is wrong, and they fight these incredible battles. In some cases, it costs them their lives. What also struck me, though, in some of the stories, is that you have a absolutely courageous judge, or in some cases a group of judges, that make historic decisions and literally almost make law in some of foreign countries where they really didn't have any environmental statutes at all. So maybe you could talk a little bit about the role of the judge who says, we need to fix this problem. That kind of mentality of the courageous judge.
Yeah, that's a very new phenomenon, and I think it's probably the most controversial phenomenon in all of environmental law. It is the role of the judge. Historically, traditionally, conservative, what do judges do? What does the law do? It protects privilege. It protects power, right? But along comes this new kind of suit in which citizens are saying, wait a minute, the public trust is being screwed up, and courts are forced into this new role, protecting public interests. Well, it's a very uncomfortable role for judges. When we passed all the laws that we passed in the United States, and those laws had citizen suit provisions, then the United States got over the bar. From then on, all of the U.S. programs would be driven forward by citizen suits. The government's supposed to regulate carbons. They don't do it. They go to court, goes to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court tells EPA, hey, you can't duck climate change anymore. You got to deal with it. So no matter how politicized an issue is, eventually citizens are going to be able to bring it to court. That's U.S. But there's no such experience abroad. No such experience abroad. So what happened in other countries when the first cases like Mineral King and Storm King came on, courts were treating it on an absolutely blank sheet of paper. Absolutely blank. And they could have done the traditional thing and said, well, you know, you're not hurt financially. I don't see, you know, you've got what's... You have a diffuse interest. You're not injured in any way that other people aren't interested. Everybody's breathing bad air. So what? Suck it up. Get used to it. They could have done that. But what you find abroad is judges reaching out and saying, you know, these are like integration. These are like civil rights decisions. Just reaching out and saying, this is wrong. And not having much law behind them. They're interpreting laws and they're interpreting constitutional provisions and saying, you're violating the constitutional rights of the general public by allowing this or that to happen. So we did ours in the United States by statute and very prescriptive laws. What you find abroad and what's happening with these cases is the idea of citizens being able to sue is catching on, and it's catching on in places that are law short. So the court's not only letting citizens sue in these courts, and in some cases it's extraordinary. In some countries, your ability to sue requires no more than writing the court a letter, sort of like a habeas corpus. But they're also arriving at substantive results and, in fact, taking control of the environmental machinery, inventing the environmental machinery of the country. It's stupendous. It's happened in Greece. It happens in Russia. It's happened in Japan, the Philippines, India. India is probably the most extreme example. Chile. Quite extraordinary. It is the judges who are leading the environmental revolution in many countries of the world, the judges.
You know, it strikes me as ironic that we have a local federal judge here whose first name is also Oliver, who's in the middle of the biggest battles over water in California right now. He's alternately attacked by, in some cases, the agribusiness interests of the western San Joaquin Valley, who are trying to get more water out of the Delta. Or on occasion, in some of his interim rulings, he will be attacked by the environmentalist. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the judge says publicly he's just trying to follow the Endangered Species Act. Mm-hmm. The current concern, and, you know, I'm kind of having been in the water battles and environmental wars for several decades now, I get a little gloomy and pessimistic, but some of the stories in your book are inspirational and give us hope. But in California now, Senator Dianne Feinstein just yesterday came out with a proposal to suspend the Endangered Species Act on economic grounds, that we could risk ecological collapse in the Delta to send more water south into the desert, you know, selenium-tainted farmlands of the western San Joaquin Valley. And so I just wonder if you remain hopeful or... in terms of the environment movement in America.
Wow. You have to. But that isn't to say I don't have very dark moments. This is such a roller coaster. This whole field, I don't think there's a field like it that has so many highs and lows in contemporaneously. Just when we thought climate change was the issue that was going to lift all boats and, you know, move the country forward towards sustainable energy and transportation and living systems and the rest, then comes this counterattack from industry and from, you know, a wing of the Republican Party, and suddenly that what looked like a clear sky is clouded up again. On the other hand, I see Lisa Jackson at EPA moving forward like gangbusters on some pollution issues like the Chesapeake Bay that have defied solution for 30 years, and she's bumping heads and kicking rear ends. God.
We win some, we lose some.
Luckily, there's, you know... that's the beauty part of this movement, too, Lloyd, is that it has no leader. You know, there isn't any Martin Luther King of this movement. There isn't any John L. Lewis. There are thousands of people who are leading their fights. And just like, it's like the theory of biodiversity. You have so many organisms out there that when the storm comes through, it's going to affect some, but others are going to thrive and survive. And I think that's kind of like this here, too. The fact of economic crunch puts some programs in jeopardy, but it really assists other programs. I mean, how many bad Corps of Engineers projects, I mean, how many new boondoggles do you think are going to pop out of this administration? They're broke.
Right.
So, you know, a lot of nasty stuff isn't going to happen, and a lot of good stuff isn't going to happen because of the economic situation. You can flip the coin. Now we're flush with money again, and we've got, you know, more money going into sewage treatment and more money going to stormwater control and more money into endangered species. But taken at the same time, you're going to get 17-lane highways and you're going to get 5 new airports and you're going to get no end of stuff. So, right. You know, Disney World 9 and 10. So
mixed blessing.
A merry mixed blessing. Mm. All I can tell you about the endangered species act is that...
It's under assault.
It has been under assault since the Teleco Dam case said that, yes, it means what it says.
Right.
And efforts have been perennial to get rid of it, to gut it, to suspend it, to do this with it. I don't think that has any traction in the Democratic Party. It may have some traction with Ron Emanuel, but I don't think it has traction in the Democratic Party. And
I agree. Listen, Professor Huck, we're almost out of time. I want to tell our listeners again, we've been discussing the book Taking Back Eden, 8 Environmental Cases That Changed the World. Wonderfully written. There's some humor in here. There's a lot of optimism. And our guest is the author, Oliver Huck. He's a professor of law at Tulane University. We've got about 2 minutes left, Professor, I wonder what you can tell my listeners out here in Central California who care about the environment. You know, what can the average citizen do in America today to make a change?
Act local. Act local. Don't let the panorama defeat you, you know. Don't let the new coal-fired power plants that China's bringing on defeat you. Actually, China will get its house in order before we will. The only thing that wins is people. And here's what I would like you to know. You're not alone. You're not alone. There are people just like you fighting to save the Louisiana Coastal Delta. And there are people who are bleeding over a tiny little refuge called the Darby Marsh up outside of Philadelphia. It's a postage stamp, you know, it's like 10 city blocks, but people are really throwing in bake sales, their money, their whatever, into trying to save this place, and they're going to court.
Never lose faith.
No, it's, I think it was Margaret Mead. Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed people can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has.
Well, that's a great...
So I kind of live by that.
Okay, that's great. Listen, again, for our listeners, Taking Back Eden, 8 Environmental Cases That Changed the World. We didn't even get into at the start of the show. We said we were going to talk about Mr. Mehta in India, who saved the Taj Mahal from industrial pollution. The beautiful marble at the Taj was being destroyed by the pollution. And maybe next time we talk, Professor, we'll discuss the Taj Mahal and some of the other great battles.
Yeah.
It's been a pleasure visiting with you, and we'll talk again soon.
I enjoyed it, Lloyd. Good luck to you, and good luck to your listeners, okay?
Thank you, Professor. Good talking. See
Bye-bye.
You soon. Okay. KFCF 88.1 FM, this is Lloyd Carter. We'll see you next month, second Friday at 3 p.m. Thanks for listening.
This is listener-sponsored radio KFCF Fresno, owned and operated by the Fresno Free College Foundation.